We're doing a lot of episodes about AI lately.
Always trust the process.
Welcome to another episode of Trust the Process, a podcast produced by the Martin Trust Center for MIT Entrepreneurship. My name is Chris, and I'm the host around here. Today, I'm joined by Bernardo Aceituno.
Hello, I'm Bernardo Aceituno, co-founder of Stack AI.
And Pablo Omeniaca.
Hello, I'm Pablo, and I run product and operations at Stack AI.
Bernardo is the co-founder of Stack AI, a company that previously went through our Delta V Accelerator program. Pablo is one of their earliest employees and previously participated in our Fuse program. Stack AI helps enterprise clients create custom AI models without prior AI experience. As Bernardo explains it, Stack allows those closest to a business's pain points solve problems with low-code AI models. In today's episode, we discuss the future impact of artificial intelligence, the unique features of the Stack platform, and the possibility of designing a neurotic, self-doubting AI model, otherwise known as an artist. Whose idea was this, this sort of platform?
Wow, that's a long story.
That's two different questions, yes.
Yeah, so, no, like,
let's start with the idea, no?
Yeah, it's true, because, you know, it all starts from kind of like the inception of the platform. You know, the story of Stack AI is pretty long, but to keep it short, when we finished our PhDs, both Tony, my co-founder, and I, we were very interested in how to make AI models more reliable or more adaptable to specific situations that companies may face. That led us to the conclusion that a big part of that was kind of like crafting better data sets for training AI models. And we basically built a small application for that. And we got a few users for it, you know, like a few startups that were interested in using that software. We managed to get into Y Combinator with that idea. And, you know, it's after finishing our PhD and working with them, we started becoming very interested in natural language processing. ChatGPT had just come out, and we started seeing how companies were asking more and more on how they could use this technology to answer questions. And after trying to use our software to curate data sets, we realized that, especially working with clients ourselves, kind of like with people that had this problem, that the biggest issue was not really crafting a data set, but rather, how do you kind of ingest data in a way that a language model can interpret? And we found out that most of the work that happens to take an application from idea to production with a language model ends up being in orchestrating things. How do you load data? How do you search through it? How do you ingest it? And how do you send it to a language model? How does the language model track a conversation with it or use it to complete a pipeline? And we said it would be amazing if there could be a software that could help you kind of like with Lego blocks assemble a pipeline like this. And we basically made a small, I wouldn't even say an MVP, I would say like a small video animation showing how this will work. We took a screenshot of it. We put it on an internal forum. And we already got, and right away from just that post, we got like 10 companies signed up to try it. So we said, well, I guess we have to build it. So we put a lot of effort in like getting that out of the gate. That was during Y Combinator. So we were like working like crazy at the time. And we managed to deliver an MVP out of it and, you know, gave it to our first set of customers, worked with them. And well, the rest is history. We launched the product in April, kind of like publicly. And now Stack AI is used by like, you know, more than 199 companies. So, and over 40,000 users. So it's been an exciting journey, much more to come, but that's how the idea got started.
Yeah, that's the process.
And how, you said that this company has sort of been 3 years in the making at this point. Would that be somewhat accurate?
I would say that, yeah, it's, you could say what has been like 1 year in the making, 3 years in the making. The inception of it happened with me and my co-founder. To give you some context, both of us were doing our PhDs here at MIT together. Both of us working in algorithms, machine learning. I was doing optimization algorithms, applied for robotics. He was doing computer vision. And both of us knew we wanted to do something together from the very beginning. You know, we met the first day at MIT almost. And since then, we became friends and knew we wanted to kind of come back to the entrepreneurial world. So we started kind of like testing ideas out. I think that whether it was the beginnings of the company or not, we kind of started testing out what we could do actually with the Trust Center about 3 years ago. Then we started doing MIT Fuse as a program. And we weren't really doing this company together, but we kind of like were tapping the waters to see what would make sense to do in the spaces of machine learning, data optimization, computer vision, natural language processing. So, you know, it's from the moment that you decide you want to build something all the way until you launch it, it can be a long time. And, you know, I would say that for us, it seems like an overnight kind of like a deliver story, but we've been testing and looking at ideas for a while. But, you know, most of it was when we were students. So, it's hard to count that out.
And then I joined last summer. So I was not there, you know, at the very beginning of the Stack AI. But yes, no, I mean, those programs here at the Martin Trust are amazing, really, to iterate ideas. And I even did the Fuse last year with another idea. And then I joined the guys over the summer and it's been a ride. So.
For a lot of people, AI is something that feels like it came out of nowhere, like within the last 12 months. I guess, at what point did you both realize that there was a commodifiable future to AI?
I would say we were on the know, indeed, that we knew about this technology. And, you know, we've been doing machine learning and AI for, you know, probably the last decade in some sense. So we were very aware of what it could do. I think that what really shifted over the past year and a half has been how the public has started to perceive AI as something useful. Before, I think that most people, either at the enterprise or at the consumers, will see AI as something that required, you know, data scientists to craft a model and could only do one thing, like count boxes or something like that. And it was clear to the consumer, to the public, since ChatGPT came out, that it actually can be used for a broader variety of things without the need for you to build extremely tailored solutions to problems. And I would say that was the thing that sparked our interest into this field, into pursuing this direction, more than helping people kind of craft their own model and kind of like solve a super specific problem, which has a ton of value, by the way, still. But, for us, it was more of an interest to see how we could use existing technologies and kind of like enable people across industry and enterprise to use them.
For me, it was a little bit different because of my background. So I was working for BCG for almost 5 years in Madrid office in Spain before coming to Sloan. And over there, I was doing a lot of projects with like the data analytics division of BCG. And I was, you know, seeing what AI could do, traditional AI, not generative AI, could do for, you know, large companies in the sense of, you know, automating processes, making work faster and better. So I was actually deploying those internal tools or use cases across many organizations. And this approach of using generative AI to solve, you know, specific problems at a medium or large company or small company was something that I had in mind. And when I heard about Stack AI very early in the days, so when they were at Y Combinator, I was like mind blown by the idea. You know, it was like connecting my background in consulting, you know, helping people be more efficient at work with this new technology, generative AI, that really, you know, sparked my interest. And I joined the guys over the summer and it's been a ride. Yeah.
We had this professor, Ethan Mollick from Duke, who's apparently well-known in the AI space, on the podcast recently. And he said something that interested me, that AI was proving that like proprietary data is not as is not going to be as important as people think in the future. And I see that reflected in how the Trust Center has been using their disciplined entrepreneurship framework. It seems more important with an AI tool like yours that a company have a strong framework of information that they can plug into the system, but not necessarily like raw data. Does that bifurcation make sense to you, that like there's a difference between disciplined entrepreneurship as a framework, but it's not necessarily a data set?
Yeah. And I think that's the beauty as well of generative AI. So you have those already pre-trained models that a company can use, and they don't have really to fine-tune them again. So those models are right now good enough for anyone at a company to use it, and they don't have to, you know, have, you know, terabytes of data available to fine-tune a model and then use it, which is, based on my experience at BCG, I could see that companies, like, this is something really hard for them because they have data scattered around the company in silos, in different, you know, infrastructures, and it's very difficult for them to gather all this data to build, you know, those AI models in the traditional way. So that's, in a sense, that's the beauty of generative AI, that is already pre-trained. It's a model that is already very smart, And you can have anyone at the company, you know, adding gigabytes or megabytes of particular, you know, information about the company, and then get amazing results. Mm-hmm. So that's the shift in how these models are used.
Yeah, I think that an analogy I like to make for kind of this that helps me frame where do I see our software evolving into the future is what happened to Excel when it came out. I think that before graphical interfaces, whenever you needed some sort of analysis on a spreadsheet, you had to run, you know, write a script in whatever language people were using at the time, B or, or Basic. And based on that script, you know, run analysis on the table, do your forecast, and then output something. When spreadsheet software through graphical interfaces like Excel came out, it enabled anybody to just take a spreadsheet they already have or some data they had and run quick, meaningful analysis on it without the need for you to be writing scripts or automations or without you, the need for you to be in the weeds of working with code. It just shows kind of how kind of technology permeates society when it becomes easy to use, because the use case were there since the beginning. It just enabled anybody to apply them effectively. And I think that's kind of like what's been driving industry and society growth for like the past 30 years. And in our end, we think AI is going to go in a similar direction. It's going to become a technology that people will, in their day-to-day, integrate to their days, to their operations, to their workflows, to kind of like how they run their day-to-day lives. And the vision of Stack AI is to enable that. In the same way Excel enabled analysts to build models really quickly, or, you know, even, you know, complex models that could be helpful and then could derive value for them.
I've seen Stack AI's backend when Doug has been showing me some of how they set up the discipline entrepreneurship AI models that they've been using. And it sort of reminded me of what happened like 5 years ago with website design, where you had like Wix, Squarespace, all these people come on the scene. And it made designing a very nice website easy. The funny thing that also happened, though, is that like really well-designed websites became even more like valuable, right? So like, and so I'm wondering what you think about that concept being applied to your idea, right? If you make AI usable to a very high standard, will there still be room at the top for people doing really highly specialized things? Or does that question make sense at all?
Yeah, it does make sense. And I think that there's definitely an analogy to be made there as to when the bar raises because everybody's accessible to technology, it makes people kind of question more, okay, where is the value on having a language model working in my company? I think that before people had an idea of where it could fit in, maybe like 2 years ago, 3 years ago when GPT-3 came out. And many of the assumptions people had on where AI could be valuable, could be useful, have been some validated thanks to the broader access to this technology. Because now you can actually build something, ship it to someone, test it and see, okay, having this resume reviewing assistant actually is very helpful or maybe not. I think it's uncovering slowly. I think people are still kind of like experimenting and tapping into what is the actual value of AI. Some of the main use cases have been more than validated already, like in training, research or so. But having this tech, kind of like tools like ours be there as enablers, I think that it benefits in general, kind of the public that can consume this technology. I think there'll still be room for more specialized things for sure, especially when it comes to high performance environments, security, or kind of like very tailored tasks, where, you know, having the expertise to build this technology from scratch is definitely going to become valuable. However, when the bar is raising, you know, people are able to detect and smell where value is much faster.
Yeah, I fully agree. No, if you see the history of technology, I mean, it's like a stack of technology building on top of each other. You can see it in software as well. So we are not coding in assembly language. So our approach in Stack AI really is to make, you know, generative AI as accessible as possible for anyone. So you don't need to code, you don't need to know about the specific of AI. You just need to focus on a specific problem that you've identified, and you use Stack AI to really tackle it. So in a sense, I think it's like positive to have this type of, you know, horizontal platform as what it happened with web pages. So now anyone can really, you know, launch their business and build very quickly a website. So our view is the same for generative AI. So anyone that has identified a problem that can be solvable with generative AI, they can do it very easily by themselves. So,
what are we meant to understand when we hear that an AI model is smart? I know you said earlier that like these models can be very smart, but like, what does that mean? Not to be dismissive of what you were saying, but like, what does that mean?
I would say is a model that is able to understand what you are asking to it, and also can, provide a response that is to the level of what a user would expect of someone answering the question. And you can see this in many different dimensions. So you can see, a response from a large language model from a very easy, question from the user. And then you can have this same model doing actions as well. So sending an email or going into a database and extract a specific, data mm-hmm. point that the user has asked. So there's a broad range of complexity in the answers that, in the questions that a user can make to the large language model. And you can feel that GPT-4 is way smarter than GPT-3.5. In this type of range of complexity that it can handle. By using those models, you can immediately see get the feeling that the model is like smart. It's answering correctly like a human would do.
I think it's a combination of induction and like synthesis, if you would say that way. Like being able to deduce and induct doing inductive analysis and deductive analysis on data, as well as being able to synthesize thought, kind of what we call thoughts or kind of ideas, what brings value on the context of a language model. And I think that clearly these metrics have improved drastically. And there's significant research on the emerging properties of language models and how they have been arising drastically over the past couple of years, the past 2 years, to be honest. And it's kind of miraculous. It's very beautiful when you see the actual kind of evolution of the technology and how it led us to this. There's still more room for improvement, of course, but in terms of deductive, inductive, and synthesis abilities, they're definitely to the point in which they can be very helpful for a lot of tasks.
Hmm. Do AI models create anything?
Ooh, that's a good question. What do you define by create?
Do they have original thought, or is it simply a process of extremely fast intake and extremely fast synthesis of what it's intaking? Or is it making its own creative decisions when it's making the synthesis? The reason I ask this is because it does seem to suggest that AI will change our understanding of what creativity is.
Yeah, that's a tough question to answer. And for sure, if you consider creation as taking different concepts of ideas and combining them to give you something, a poem or a drawing, for sure AI models are able to create something. You can go to Midjourney, ask him to draw you a cat riding an elephant on the moon, and he will do it. And that, for me, that's quite impressive sometimes. And but for the matter of creativity, it depends on how you define creativity. I will argue that if you are saying that creativity is coming up with something that no one has seen before, you could say, okay, like I'm gonna give you a lot of random freedom to do random things. And because this is a parameter you can actually change in this language and generative AI models. Feel free to write random stuff. And the moment that I see something and no one has written before, I'll call that creative. I could argue that there's some degree of creativity with existing generative AI technologies. To the degree in which I think humans are able to create them, it's much tougher to say. And I think that now that AI models, just beyond text, for audio, for images, for video, are becoming widely available, this question will become more and more of a question that we need to address. I would say that language models at this point are not as good at synthesizing data in the same way that a human can do it when they want to match a style or a tone. So that's good for writers as of today. But for sure, there will be a point. I think there will be an inflection point, like maybe when GPT-5 comes out, maybe later, where it will be very hard to know if something was creatively made by a human or it was actually triggered by a language model.
Hmm. Yeah, and I'd wonder if that's also getting back to the metaphor of the easy to make website, is that as it gets more and more difficult to understand whether a human is the primary motivating force behind a creation, the level that you expect
someone who's working professionally as an artist or as a creative will just simply get higher, right? Maybe there's not really that sort of back and forth. But I think that's just something that I wonder about. Like, it makes you think, what is creativity? Because if it really is just like connecting disparate, traditionally not connected ideas, it would seem that AI should be able to do that really well,
yeah.
But it doesn't seem to do it well yet.
Yeah, I agree.
And so there's like that's what always confuses me, right? Like whenever I'm trying to use AI.
I think it would be very promising whenever a language model or an AI model can manage to prove some sort of mathematical problem that we humans haven't proven yet. Like sometimes I, for fun, ask GPT-4, like, prove me the Riemann hypothesis, to which it replies, wow, that's quite the task. But I think that that's the direction where I think AI will start really like benefiting humanity massively, when they can actually solve problems that we humans, you know, just because of like the limited amount of resources we have, even brain power, you know, cannot solve. And the moment that an AI model can prove the Riemann hypothesis or find the cure to a very rare disease by doing science in some sense, internally, I think that that will be a very transformational moment for humanity. Mm-hmm. And I think it touches in the core of this question, you know, is, you know, how much can they actually like use the knowledge that they have? You know, we call them they at this point, believe that, for solving problems and, you know, maybe for achieving things that we humans cannot achieve yet.
Right.
And I think it's already happening in some fields. So if you see biotech with, I think it was released some time ago, DeepMind coming up with, I don't know how many thousands of new proteins, thanks to their model, that, you know, humans are not able to discover those proteins at that scale. I think it's something, you know, that is happening in some fields, and I'm sure it's going to happen more and more, and it's going to enable us to, you know, explore, you know, areas of knowledge and progress that it would have been very difficult for us to go alone.
That's interesting. You know, do AI models learn by doing? In the sense that, like humans, people often say the best way for a human to learn is by simply like doing the process. Is that essentially how AI is trained?
Very much, actually. Like I would say that before, in the previous generation of language models, let's say in GPT-3 or so, they learn by predicting what's the next word, or so. And I think that what unlocked a lot of what we achieved today with ChatGPT and you know these anthropic models has been injecting this learning by doing component into their training. It's what people call reinforcement learning with human feedback, RLHF. It's what what they do basically is that, okay, they train this huge model with all the internet in order to predict text. So, you know, it can, you know, tell you what the next word for a sentence will be, or, you know, if you are writing an article, what will be the next few words in an article. When you encode, you're basically compressing the entire internet into this kind of model, in the prediction model. You're basically encoding knowledge there. You're saying, okay, if I say what's the temperature of the sun is, you know, it will tell me the temperature of the sun. Now, what they do after for it, and I think it's actually quite magical in some sense, is that they start taking this model and they inject an additional layer of kind of like a training by doing, where they ask it, okay, what will be the answer? What should you say after someone makes a request like, hello? Should we like complete the sentence hello, or should we reply like hello as well? And they basically an additional layer of what we call reinforcement learning, where they essentially like start giving humans the ability to rank what answer was better or worse, and they train it like that. They train a reward model for that, and then with a reward model, they fine tuning that large language model to behave more like a conversational model, actually to align it to what we would expect it to do. This is actually quite critical for the security of language models. That's how you ensure that GPT will not let you build a bomb, or it will not let you harm a human. That's in how they encode this in this process. And the magical thing is that despite going through this additional process of learning how to respond to a question or so, they still retain a big chunk of the knowledge that they received when they were being trained. Which, if you have trained a machine learning model yourself, it's quite counterintuitive that could happen. It's essentially by doing or so that they take the model from, you know, just a prediction system to an intelligence you can interact with. And we're getting to the point in which I think these GPT-4.5, GPT-4 are being trained by having other language models kind of like tell it the feedback on like, hey, this is a good answer, it's a bad answer. So they're getting to a point in which AI is telling AI how good it is and, you know, how to improve. So it's a delicate process. And I think that, you know, it's going to evolve much more in the coming years. but it's for sure the intuition of, you know, how do you get, Andre Karpathy, one of the founders of OpenAI, says, beyond human level of reasoning. Mm-hmm. And that's what happened in many problems in robotics or, you know, protein folding or chess or, you know, that's what, how AlphaZero, the big chess model, was trained, or AlphaGo were trained, to the point which they could like reliably beat any human or the world champion in a game. I can see this scaling up to the point of having this really super powerful language models by training by doing.
Hmm. Do you ever worry that presuppose, like, that sort of vision presupposes that we understand human rationality, like that we already understand human rationality?
That's a good question. I'm not sure if that implies it. In some sense, it does imply that we understand what we humans want, or that we understand what is aligned to our values or our goals. I would say most humans are somewhat aligned to what we want. Not every human. It basically relies on that assumption. And I think that a lot of the research that is, you know, happening inside of these big AI research labs is towards ensuring that this alignment process can be done effectively by kind of like adhering to key values of society.
Hmm.
I mean, Anthropic has done fantastic research in this direction, and a lot of their published work kind of like pushes on this question. If you ask the most alarmistic people, they'll tell you, wow, we shouldn't train models anymore until we understand this pretty well. If you ask the most optimistic people, they'll say we should train them faster. So there's a wide range of opinions from experts on how this should evolve. And to me, it's fascinating. I see it somewhere in the middle in there, but there's for sure something that people are concerned about.
So we could maybe talk a little bit about like a specific use case that that you guys have for your particular app that seems to have been like really indicative of your software as a whole, or the possibilities for your software as a whole. Mm-hmm. Is there a particular company that y'all have been working with that would seem to really be a good model for, no pun intended, for explaining your company?
So no, in terms of use cases, I mean, we see, you know, a broad range of different use cases for different industries. So really generative AI can be applied in many, many settings. Yesterday we were talking about, or we were explaining one specific use case to a professor here at MIT Sloan. And it has to do with one of our users, one of the companies that is using Stack AI, and they are using it to build a very customized, you know, application to detect non-compliant emails or calls from their sales representatives. Okay, so they go into Stack AI, they put an input, a large language model, and an output, and they specify, you know, in the prompt of the large language model, how to detect this non-compliance based on, you know, internal rules they have in the company. They can even, you know, attach specific, you know, documents, elaborating a little bit more on what is compliant and what is not. And they built like a prototype in a few hours. They test it out, they share it internally within the organization. And then in a couple of weeks, it was in production, you know, processing thousands of emails and thousands of phone calls from sales representatives. And actually, in terms of impact, I mean, it allowed them to shorten the process of, you know, checking those emails and sales by 80%. So. Mm. In terms of the time that it took them before to, you know, go manually, listen to all the sales calls and trying to identify which one were compliant or not. Now with generative AI, you can do this very fast. And with tools such as Stack AI, you can build those applications in a matter of hours on weeks at most to bring something to production. So that's a really good example of, you know, the potential of generative AI and also of building this type of applications with Stack AI.
Yeah, something maybe to add is that in this specific company, actually, none of the people that were involved in building this solution were engineers or developers or had any background in AI. Mm. So that's what kind of amazes me. You know, a company can come and, you know, people that understand the problem very deeply because of their actual involvement in the process, which is, you know, not an engineering-based process, but a compliance-based process, can design a system, test it, share it with the organization, and then take it to production to be a essential part of their operation.
Mm. Mm. Yeah, it's like bringing this amazing technology, so generative AI, closer to the people that are feeling the pain or that are feeling this specific pain point. And having them, you know, figure out at least a prototype, you know, or at least a very basic applications to solve the issue and then scale from there.
Hmm. How do you manage the like the help desk for a company that's has that many clients but that few people working at it?
Well, I mean, we leverage, of course, like technology. So we have a community in Discord, and you see, you know, a bunch of people, you know, raising like issues with the tool and also feature requests. So it's a vibrant community of people that are early adopters, I would say, of the product, and they are keen as well in helping each other. So this is helping us a lot. And then, of course, we have, you know, Slack channels with the customers that are paying, and we support them 24/7. So it's challenging because, you know, we are a small company still, but yeah, we leverage technology, and then at the end of the day, it's software. So, you know, when you find a bug and you fix it, you send it to production as fast as you can, yeah, with the review of the team, of course, and then that's it. So the feedback loop is very quick. That's the beauty of software.
Yeah, I would say that it's actually beneficial to put developers to support, because the moment that they get like three messages for the same problem, they fix it right away. You know, in my case, I fix it right away. or, you know, Paolo fixes it right away. But, you know, it puts the company in perspective of what are the problems of the users, and you see it, you kind of like it from the first hand.
Yeah. That's an important point, because it's true that we are, you know, only four people in the company right now. But we all know how to code. So when we see an issue from the client, from the customer, it's our own responsibility to fix it. So we don't wait for like the developer to code it. So it's ourselves. We fix it, we push it, and then the customer is happy. So.
I'm going to use another sort of, I think the only way we can really effectively talk about AI is right now is through analogy, because it's so new that like as it becomes more common, like we won't need to use as much metaphor and analogy to talk about it because we'll have a deeper understanding of it. But for right now, I think it's really only useful to talk in analogy. But I was having a conversation recently, and the conversation revolved around producing a record, like a music record. The direction of the conversation was one of the people in the conversation was saying that when they create something, they want to know how to do every part of that process. And that's what they find to be the idea of being an artist. Mm-hmm. There was another person in the conversation who said, well, I don't really think that's the case. Like, I don't need to know how to work a specific piece of recording software. I just need to know how to find a person who knows how to do it so that I can express my ideas through it. The reason I bring this up is because it seems like what AI potentially has the possibility of doing is with much lower capital costs, giving a lot more people access to like mid-level expertise that in the past would have taken a year, 2 years for someone to teach themselves, but they can now rely on a tool to do it for them instead. Is that something that you're seeing with the way companies are using these tools? Is that, does that analogy sort of relate to what the problem that you were just talking
about?
Yeah.
I think 100%. So with generative AI, you know, the cost of, you know, applications or coding is going to go down dramatically. So you can as well think, you know, what's going to happen with, you know, software as a service, you know. Why a company is going to be using, you know, Salesforce if they can, you know, code very cheaply their own CRM? And I don't know the answer, of course, so this is the beginning of everything. But it's a direction that is worth thinking about, you know. What's going to happen with software as a service, you know, businesses, if companies can build their own very customized use cases internally very cheaply and very, you know, reliably and with anyone really having access to this technology? And so it's an interesting direction, and I see people really, honestly, like people having, you know, their own use cases, so their own AIs, you know, applications around them, helping them to be more efficient. And I really believe that nowadays, with tools such as Stack AI, everyone can really build their own customize AI applications in a matter of hours. So it's a very promising future, honestly.
So I think I'm going to give you a situation, and then maybe you can tell me how a potential customer would interact with your platform to solve the situation. So something that I always forget about, like old emails, and I never remember when I've agreed to do something. And so I was thinking the other day, it'd be great to have an AI that could like read all my emails and remind me when I've forgotten to reply to something. So if I wanted to develop that using Stack AI, how would that, let's just presume for argument's sake that I have no AI experience.
Yeah.
What would it look like? What would it look like when I sat down at the computer and opened the web interface? And then like, what would it look like as I got closer to a solution?
Yeah, I think the process to achieving a successful application of AI is thinking about it as a hierarchy of kind of like thoughts. First of all, you wanna ask yourself, do I really need AI to do this? Is it something I could do without AI just by having a spreadsheet or something, or having some sort of like automation running in the background that has no AI to it? That's probably the first question you need to ask yourself. I think in your case, probably does require some level of AI because it needs to understand if there was a task there and it's natural language and it's probably not super easy to parse. After that, I will ask myself, okay, if I were to build a workflow to do this, what should be the workflow? It probably should be
like a real world workflow. Would I first design like if I were to do this myself, this is how I would do it? Or
yeah, it's very much what you would do in Stack AI. It's blocks you connect. But I would, you know, even more high level, kind of like, what is the process that needs to run to happen, to for this to happen? I would say, okay, you need for your system to, with some frequency, look at your emails, store them having a knowledge base, look for tasks that were not completed yet, send you an email if it found any. So that already has some high level of complicated logic there. You know, like first it needs to somehow have a database of your emails that, you know, is being updated regularly. Then having a database that, you know, it checks if a task was completed or not, and then have a system that can query an email, understand it, and flag it as the task was completed or not. So the way that, you know, given this, I would say, okay, the inputs to my model are for sure then. I need to have a way to like look at every email I receive or sent. Then from there, categorize it as it completed a task or it didn't. If it didn't, if it asked me to do a task, I should store it in a database of tasks. If it didn't, I should just ignore it and keep going. Then I should have another process that regularly looks at a database of tasks. And if one is not completed, then, send me an email with the uncompleted task. And then have a third system that regularly looks at my emails and looks at, okay, for each of the uncompleted tasks, did I complete it or not? This will be probably three Stack AI projects. One of them that like, you know, where you will put first as an input, a trigger that every time you receive an email, it detects if it's, it has a task in it or not. If there's a task in it or not, I would store it in a database, as in a SQL database or so. I would ask a language model to do that. You can do it in Stack AI. And then just complete a task with that. Then have a second workflow that also receive every time you send or receive an email and looks if there's a task associated with it in the database. You know, you could do this with a vector database or with a SQL database with Stack AI. And then with a language model check, did this email complete that task? Yes or no? If it did, take the task out of the database. Then in a third Stack AI project, have what we call a cron job or a scheduled task that will, with every certain free cadence, let's say every 6 hours every day, kind of like look at the database, find all the uncompleted tasks and send me an email about them with the associated, a link to the associated email. And that's probably the way I would build this. There will be some nuance on the way you construct this database. How would you effectively search through it? It's something you could for sure do in Stack AI that way. And that's the way I would always think about AI first. You know, what are the processes that need to happen there? Kind of like if I were a person doing this, if I were to hire three people to do this task, what would they be doing?
Yeah, right.
And then translate that to, okay, what would a language model have to do? Similar, that you will do the same analysis to draft a contract writing bot or a patent reviewer bot or a training or onboarding bot, which or assistant, which are kind of like the bread and butter what we see every day. Companies building AI assistants to onboard employees or for, you know, scraping the websites or assisting salespeople or assisting HR departments.
It's interesting that the things that we want AI to do the most are generally the tasks that like are given to people whose like job descriptions are often like not considered highly logical or like highly inventive, right? Like basically what we're talking about are like administrative tasks that are perceived as simple, but which require a lot of organization. It's funny to me that AI, the way we talk about AI is that it's smart, but if you were to assign the tasks that it's completing for us to a human, the assumption wouldn't be necessarily that those people are like highly logical or highly organized. It would be like, oh, those are the people that just like keep things running. Mm. So there's an irony to that.
Yeah, I would challenge that a bit in some sense, because for instance, a very common case where you would see that, okay, this requires a human that deeply understands the problem or so, or understands the knowledge, is when it comes to education or training or onboarding people. And we've seen actually AI being used very widely for this use case. Okay, let's assist on a task that will require a deep understanding of a subject to either give feedback to someone, to assess their knowledge, or to clarify questions. And you can see actually here in the Discipline Entrepreneurship workbook, like that's something for which we'll hire a professor to analyze, to assist you with it. It is true that a lot of where we see AI being used today is in this kind of like a back office administrative work. But the more and more I see it being used for tasks that will be considered like highly cognitively demanding tasks or like highly valuable tasks, it's also surprised me. It's been growing for sure. And I can see a world where lawyers, doctors, you know, these positions that, you know, have huge salaries are just fully disrupted because of how AI is being used there. And I've seen it in some sense, like you see like people more commonly asking, you know, legal questions to ChatGPT or Perplexity, or even, you know, within Stack AI, building workflows to analyzing compliance or analyzing or, you know, drafting complex documents that have this nuanced task. So there's an argument to say that the value for AI, we think more complex, more intelligence demanding tasks, it's going to grow more and more.
Hmm. Yeah, we put some ideas through the model that they're developing here, and it was really uncanny. Even just putting it through the first step of Discipline Entrepreneurship, it was already identifying things that took us, you know, 2-3 months to realize would be speed bumps in the design of a business. It spit it out in like 2 seconds. It's just uncanny. So that is a definite example of, I think, what you're referencing. Like, as it continues to move towards that, I don't know exactly what it'll do, because I still think there are just some people who have the drive to make new things, to do new things.
Yeah.
And having a lot of tools to make new things doesn't necessarily make anyone inherently interested in doing that.
Yeah.
So there'll still be this class of people who are driven to make new things, but the tools will be more democratic. More people will have access to them, even if the number of people who are driven to make new things doesn't change.
I see that. I think that, you know, something similar happens in robotics, for instance. You know, I worked in robotics for a while, and you see how, you know, precision welding, you know, welding or soldering used to be like a, you know, a really high demanding task for kind of you know, skilled workers, and it required like high levels of skill. Whereas, you know, some tasks like packing boxes is considered, okay, this is something, you know, anybody can do. There are many robots and machines out there that can do very precise welding and, you know, assembly of, you know, complex, you know, devices and, you know, maybe look at computers, iPhones or so. At the same time, you know, like there's still people packing boxes. And if you try to design a robot for packing boxes or unloading a truck, you realize that, wow, this actually is pretty hard to automate. And so we make the joke that, you know, me and my co-founder, you know, people think that like the words that will be first replaced by AI will be like, these blue collar kind of jobs. But probably the ones that will replace the first will be the white collar jobs, lawyers, doctors or so. So, you know, all of us will become, you know, plumbers and stuff. Who knows? You know, it's an interesting thought, because it does show you, like, I wouldn't say that, you know, it's like something that repeats, but that it does show that automation does have impact, not in places where you don't expect it very often.
Mm-hmm. When we as humans are working through a problem, we will often stop, we will not complete the workflow towards completing the problem if we realize that a few steps beforehand we could have done something differently. We'll actually stop that process and return to the beginning, right? Yeah. There's no point. Humans will generally not see a point finishing just to go back and iterate. Does it Do AI models do that? Do they stop halfway through and they're like, oh shit, this isn't what I wanted to do? Or do they have to complete it and then they go to the beginning? And then they have to complete it and go to the beginning.
That's very interesting. I mean, that's a matter of design, I guess. But I do have seen sometimes language models that make a mistake in the way they reason something, encode or something, some coding task. And they just like kind of try to justify their mistake later on. Like, oh yeah, but actually if you think about it this other way, you know, it's... So they kind of go with it. But as a matter of design, if you design a system where every time it writes a line, it kind of like self-criticizes, and then from that self-criticism, it is able to reach a better conclusion, or, you know, say, oh no, I actually made this up, let's start again. I think you can get to a point where you can like stop, start again, and keep going.
A neurotic AI.
Yeah, exactly. A neurotic AI. You know, we all been there. It's like, oh snap. What my mom will say.
No, that's probably how you get to a creative, artistic AI model. You just make it extremely self-critical and neurotic and highly dependent on other people's validation, and then you have an artist.
So. Yeah, sounds like me as a kid, yeah. All right. Yeah.
Well, I think that pretty much covers everything. Was there anything else that y'all wanted to talk about specifically related to your product?
Go to www.stack-ai.com. You can open a free account today and start building some automations for yourself. It is paid if you want to like have access to more advanced features, more usage. And as an enterprise product, you know, if you need security or so, if you need more dedicated compute or support, we provide support for enterprise. It's a product very much designed for the enterprise from day one. So it's very much focused on security, privacy, and, you know, giving guarantees that it will perform even at the deepest levels of consumer demand or consumer requirements for privacy and security. If you want to try today, you can go visit www.stack-ai.com. And something to mention, we are hiring. We're growing the team. We're hiring for many more positions by the day. So any person in the community, you're more than welcome to go to our careers page and, apply to join the company and, be part of this very exciting, very fast moving journey.
Yeah. And just to add on what Bernardo was just saying, we're working on releasing an educational license for students. So even ourselves, you know, we've been through Fuse, you know, Delta V, those things. We know, you know, that there's a lot of entrepreneurs that are being formed in, Martin Trust and other places, you know, across the country and the world. So we are willing as well to support these entrepreneurs. Be aware that we're going to release something very soon for students as well.
Sweet.
Lovely.
All right. Awesome. Well, that's it for another episode of Trust the Process. This show is edited and produced by me, Chris Burns. The executive producer is Greg Weimer. We record all of our episodes at the Martin Trust Center for MIT Entrepreneurship. See you next time.